Amen. Well, thanks for having me. I just want real quickly, because I get asked this question all the time, a little bit about my background, so I'm just going to give you about a 5-10 minute history, just so you know where I've come from, and then a little bit about the organization that I'm with to create context for the next 45 minutes of interaction with you. I met the Navigators in Europe. I had accepted Christ as a young person, really committed my life to Christ when I was 13. Through Expo 72. So yes. Some of you might have been there. Absolutely. Were you there? And it was just a supernatural time when God visited me in the Cotton Bowl, and my vision at the time was to really help Christians live the abundant life that the scriptures talked about. So that's what I set my life on to do, and it wasn't until I got to Europe that I met Harvey at a NAV conference in Switzerland, and he said, "Ron, have you ever heard about discipleship?" I said, "No." He says, "Well, you need to," and that began our relationship. God has used Harv continuously throughout our lives, even to this day, in a very deep and rich way, for which I could never repay or say enough about. Joined the staff of the Navigators again through his influence. In 85, I thought I was going to seminary. He said, "No, you're not. Going to go to cemetery. You're going to come with me to West Point and help us lead this ministry at West Point." And when I met the cadets on a kind of a tour just to see what it was like, God made it very clear that's where I needed to be. So it was a no-brainer. We were there from 85 until 91 when Terry Taylor, Paul Stanley came flying through, a series of conversations, and Paul says, "You know, Ron, you really need to be challenged in your life. So what we would like for you to pray about is moving anywhere you want to move to and start a ministry to the lost wherever you plant yourself in some community." And I'm thinking, you've got to be kidding me. I mean, I didn't even understand what he was talking about. And that was a very turbulent time for me as I prayed through all this, because I also got an offer to be a pastor in Palm Desert, Palm Springs. Yeah. And that was a pretty incredible offer in itself, because the offer was to come out there in these guarded gate communities and sit in your shorts and your tennis shorts and interact with these very wealthy businessmen around who had just kind of housed there during the winter and interact with them around their faith. And but God had other plans and said, "No, it's the neighborhood thing." And so I did that. I moved to Denver, and I got to tell you that given my background, I had no idea. I had absolutely no idea what that meant. And for the next 5 or 6 years, we gave ourselves, and this was primarily through the ministry of my wife, just being active in the neighborhood and connecting, to trying to reach the lost in our neighborhood for Christ. And I got to tell you, to this day, it was very transformative in terms of my thinking. But those 5 or 6 years were probably the worst 5 or 6 years of my life, if I was to do a chronology in terms of, did I feel I was doing anything in my gift set or what I was wired to do with my life? And all the answers to that would be absolutely not. But there was no question in my mind that that's what God wanted us to do. And God used that in tremendous ways. That takes me to today. In 91, 93, on my tennis court, one of the guys started talking to me about FMI, this consulting business. And we interacted, and I wasn't looking for a job. Certainly never thought about being a consultant, for crying out loud. You know, I grew up in the Air Force and got a master's degree in religion. So I had no inclination of being a business consultant. But through a series of events, went in, did the interview thing. They said, "Why don't you come on board?" And so I did. So the first year, I was still on staff with the Navigators, still trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life. But as I was learning the industry, in this particular firm's niche industry, is anything that touches construction. So it's everything from big owners. So currently today, we're working with the state of Georgia with their big capital expenditure program, with big, like Miami-Dade Schools District, you know, for schools in terms of executing their capital expenditure, to manufacturers of construction products. So in Denver, we got Johns Manville. They do roof tile and fiberglass, and Owens Corning, you know, the Pink Panther. Down to the architect and engineering sector, and then you got the contractor. And again, I didn't have any clue about any of that stuff. But as I got engaged in learning the business, one of my observations was, consulting was interesting, but I wasn't going to do this with my life, because, you know, what I observed is that most of the time we'd come in with great solutions, but the leaders didn't know how to take the information and transform change in their business. So God began to prompt me around this thinking of, Ron, why don't you go back to your roots, which is what you're passionate about, and that's developing leaders. And so I began toying with that idea. Had a good friend of mine who took over our ministry at West Point, who I discipled while we were there, Dave Lau, who came out to Denver to get his master's degree at DU. And we began talking about what would this look like, and this leadership development business began to emerge. So that's the history of what's occurred. Now, fast forward to today, our business, and I thought I would just share this with you real quick. These are our services, and you don't need to read this, but it's a pretty comprehensive business. We have about 120 folks, 80 professionals. We're the largest consulting firm in our industry. And today we're structured in two primary businesses. We've got investment banking, which is, you know, mergers, acquisitions, private equity, valuation, roll up and take companies public in the public marketplace. And then we have consulting. And what's occurred in our reorganization over this past year is that I am leading the consulting side of our business. So I wanted you to know that, and I also wanted you to know that the makeup of the firm is that it's very secular. I mean, it's just a normal, everyday business, you know. So it does have some believers, and it's been amazing over this past year as I've led more broadly to see them coming out of the, you know, out of the closets. But the leadership group is the one that I want to talk to today in terms of what they're doing and then how it integrates with our whole, you know, view of the business and where we're going. The leadership group, as it's currently constituted, has about 20 or so full-time consultants, maybe another 40 part-time, and the part-time group is a very eclectic group. It's a very powerful group. So we have three-star generals. We have a professor at Annapolis. We have CEOs of organizations that are kind of playing. You know, they're still chairman in their organization, but they're trying to branch out and have broader influence in their lives. So we have a very eclectic group. But I would say that in the leadership group, out of that 50, pool of 50 or 60, we probably have 50% of that group that are believers. And what I want to share with you and where I want to go today is with the thinking that the Navigators asked me they challenged me with in 91. The challenge was, Ron, how do we reach the lost in the context of our neighborhood outside of, you know, normal streams of ministry, the church, you know, activities on campuses like at West Point or on the bases? You know, I supervised our military work. So we were aligned with the chaplains and all that went with that. So I was challenged in 91 to think about that from a full-time ministry perspective. In the work perspective, the thing that God had continued to burn on my heart was, how do you take a business model out to the marketplace that is still laced with biblical truth, whether or not it's being led by a believer or not? And then as I think about a ministry like the business and professional group, the question I have, and I've been asking people here this week, is, you know, what are we learning about ministering to businessmen that allows us to take biblical thinking and practice beyond just personal application? So, you know, as an organization, as Navigators, we're very focused on the personal development of leaders and of disciple makers and of laborers. But the question, and I'm all for that, and we do that, you know, those of us that are inclined this way are very passionate about that as well in our business. But the bigger question that we've been wrestling with is, how do you take this message and how do you create questions and conversations from a business perspective? You know, what could we do to contribute to our niche in the industry that would change the face of the industry because they were talking about biblical things without knowing about it in the context of their business? And I got to tell you, this is a learning curve. I don't have answers, but we're starting to see inroads into how do you create conversations from an organizational perspective. If you're dealing with a CEO, how do you help a CEO or a senior executive create conversations inside of their organization in the context of day-to-day business that allows for lots of spiritual conversation? That's the objective, is for me anyway, is how do you take normal everyday business and create a context, an opportunity for leaders in business to talk about their faith in a very safe, contextual environment. Huge challenge, obviously. You know, there are all kinds of examples of success out there from a personality-driven perspective. What we're trying to figure out is there a business solution, is there a business proposition that allows us to have these kind of conversations on a day-to-day basis. So on that note, I want to get into some of the content. Now, when we get into this content, the thing that I think you'll find surprising is we have four masters of IO psychology on our team that over the past couple of years have been putting content together. Those four people are not believers, but I want you to see what they're coming up with as they research components of organizational design and leadership. And I want you to see, and I made allusion to it this morning after listening to Eddie this morning, and I'm going to go back to that if we have time, how biblical truth can be transferred into almost any aspect of business and how true it is in terms of its impact on organizational design. So I'm going to start with this one story, and it's not so much a story, it's a piece of research. How many of you have heard of the Conference Board? The Conference Board. It's an organization, Fortune 500 type companies, they throw a bunch of money into a pot and they commission the Conference Board to go do research. One of the research pieces that they asked the board to go after was a research piece that answered the question, what do you think business leaders need to be focused in on? The actual study is called The Role of Business Leaders in the Year 2010. So what do you think the role of business leaders in the year 2010 ought to be? Well, you know, Harvard and Beeson and PDI went off and they did their research. They come back with this report. And I just want you to have context because this report is given to CEOs of very large organizations. So if you keep track of Walmart, I mean, how many employees does Walmart have today? Anybody want to take a guess? It's 1.25 million. So there's a few people, you know, that this board is coming back to report to when they talk to the CEOs that sit around the table. And here's their output. They said there's four key roles of business leaders 2010. Number one, and I'm not going to have time to unpack them. Number one is you're going to have to learn to be a master strategist. So it's very business oriented, but the idea is being a master at strategy. So you got to know the markets. You've got to read the markets well. You've got to be out in front, totally competent at mastering strategy. The second role is that you have to master change. And change is what you can predict and what you can't predict. And the interesting thing today, even in the work that Tony's in, is that the dynamic in the marketplace today is that most change that's occurring is change you can't predict. You could not have predicted that the marketplace would have imploded the way it has because of the lack of ethics of its leaders. Right? You could not have predicted that. You would not have known that Enron, Arthur Andersen, you know, Kozlowski's deal, Martha Stewart. Now it's even, what's that donut company? Krispy Kreme. Same thing, you know. It's an ethical issue that's taken that company out, you know, they're on the brink. Same issues again on transactions revolving around the ethics of their leader. Not the skills, not the talent, but the ethics of the leader. You could not have predicted 9/11. You know, there's just so much going on. So the second role is learning how to manage change as a leader. The third and the fourth are the two that I find most interesting. The third is they look at these individual leaders and they say, you, Lee Scott of Walmart, and you, Jack Immelt of GE, your third role as a leader is that you're going to have to personally be a talent developer. Talent developer. And the fourth is that you're going to have to learn how to be a relationship builder, alliance builder. Now, I want you to think about this. This is the best thinkers in the world coming back to the largest organizations in the world, and they're saying these are the four key roles. What percent of those four roles have business applications in the conventional sense? Maybe just one, huh?
Yeah, one or two. Yeah.
And you might be able to stretch something into change. You might be able to stretch something into alliance and networking. But only one had a business application. And the reason why I find this significant is because you and I are in the business, really, really, of touching people in their lives at a very personal level, at a spiritual level, at a level that counts. But when you think about the business application of the people that you're working with, the output of that is directly applicable to business if we think differently. And so I wanted to start with that because I'm going to take you through a model that we've been working on, that these young kids have been working on, that describe what we call peak leadership. And you'll see that in our model also, there are only two out of the eight critical areas that tie to business, in the conventional sense of business. And I'll be sharing some things along the way that hopefully will encourage your heart, because the research that's been coming out on organizational design, the research that's been coming out on what creates high-performing organizations. How many of you read Jim Collins' seminal studies, research work?
Good to Great.
Good to Great and Built to Last. Okay, good. And but there's other stuff out there that continue to validate and continue to affirm, you know, the research that's been done and is continuing to be done around what makes great organizations. The first thing that our group really worked on, and this is really a function of Dan Wooldridge, and some of you know Dan. Dan is a great thought leader. He helped us think through what is the impact of worldview on an organization. And again, I don't have time to unpack all this, but the essence of worldview is what informs what you believe. And another way of saying this is if you can identify what your worldview is, then you can answer the question, why do you exist as an organization? So organizationally, you can look at an organization and answer the question, why do you exist? And the research would say, and again, this most of this comes from Collins's work, and you can see all the examples in the back of his first book, Built to Last. But what the research would say is that in the core of great businesses that are built to last, their purpose never referred to their services or the products. So it never referred to making money. It never referred to the products or the services that they did. There was a much more compelling reason why Walmart is where it is today. A much more compelling reason why Stanford exists today in the West. A much more compelling reason why GE has accomplished what it's accomplished beyond just making money or our services and our products. And if you haven't read any of this, I'd really encourage you to, because at the end of the day, what I'm going to challenge us to think about in our ministry is how do we come alongside as coaches and really take conversation into the workplace that we can be equipping our leaders to have every day. Because at the end of the day, what the research would say is great organizations are bounded around clarity, around their worldview, their values, and their behaviors. But it comes from the inside out. And so for most of you, you know this. You know, coming from the work that you're doing, this stuff is very intuitive and it syncs up with the scriptures. So when we're talking to organizations and when I'm talking to personal leaders, I'll say even at the personal side, I'm going to get to this slide here in a minute. But we break out individual leader development and organizational leader development. And I'll explain more of this in a minute. But at the organizational level, we know high-performing organizations are centered around this. We also know that individual leaders are centered around this. High-impact leaders are very clear around their purpose, their values, and what they're trying to achieve. If you're a high-impact parent, you realize that you're heavily engaged in trying to help your children understand why we do what we do and the values by which we're going to live our lives. And lastly, you almost don't care what the behaviors are because you got these two things synced up right. High-performing organizations, the same way. You know if you're working with a high-performing organization, if the leaders are not having to run around the periphery all day long correcting behaviors that are going on inside their company. If they've done a good job syncing this up, they don't have to worry about this. The other lesson, intuitive lesson, is that most change attempts come in from out here. So, you know, when you think about the NAV ministry or you think about your ministry and the lives of professionals, we know that we want to get inside of here. But many times, if you were to do a self-assessment, you might find yourself out here in terms of where you focus. And what we tell our client base is most consulting firms, outside advisors, you will bring them in to do work out here. And the reason why you don't feel like you get your return on investment at the end of the day is because you haven't done the hard work as a leader in here. High-performing organizations, high-performing leaders spend most of their time in here. They're having conversations all the time, every day, out loud, around what they're trying to do, their purpose, and their values. It's pretty intuitive, but it can be pretty impactful if you haven't really thought about how do I help coach executives in the business, and then how do we create reproducible questions that they're asking their own teams as they're coaching their leaders inside their organization. I mentioned this real quick. When we think about leader and organizational development, two quadrants. One is at the individual level, and I feel like as navigators, this is where we are in the bullseye, is that we are focused on the individual leader, and there are principles that always impact leaders that are forever. Same thing happens, though, at the organizational level. There are leadership practices at the organizational level, principles, that are transferable to any organization. But you also have application, which can be really different. So the context of individual leadership will be a whole lot different inside of an organization like the Navigators than it might be in a publicly held company that we're trying to turn, you know, in the open market or sell. And so when we look at leadership and organizational development, we see it this way. And I just wanted to put this out here for you so that you had some framework to think about. When I think about coaching my leaders, it's very easy to get focused on the individual piece. The question or the challenge I would have for us is how could we learn to really help those that we're coaching to be more savvy in how they lead organizationally? And how can we be coaching them to have the right sets of questions and the right kind of perspective on how they can impact their business from an organizational perspective? Does that make sense? When we've talked about our peak leader model, this is the one that I mentioned earlier, that two of these are really more business-oriented than the other six. But at the core, when we talk about leadership and organizational development, we always start with this worldview component. Any conversation that we have at FMI, this is what it's all about, because we're talking worldview here and we're talking purpose. And if it's coming out of our leadership development group, which is just, you know, is one of the four key practice areas, I'll just share one of their core values. One of the core values for the leadership group is third generation leadership. So if you were to ask one of our leader developer consultants, you know, what's one of the core values of the leadership group, they would say it's to impart and impact this industry around third generation leadership, a concept of third generation leadership. And you're going, what does that mean? Well, you know, intuitively you know what third generation is from our Navigator background. In the business world, what we're trying to communicate is that the real legacy of a leader in their organization is to have impact on leaders who will developing other leaders around their worldview and purpose and values. And if you can create conversations so that every leader in your organization is beginning to think that way, think about the impact. I mean, you just begin to think about the impact of what happens if you have leaders who are talking to other leaders in their organization about imparting the worldview and values of this organization three generations deep. Now, I'm just going to go around this wheel real quick, and then I'll dive deep into one, just so you get a flavor. I mean, obviously, we don't have time. But this gives you a sense for the kinds of conversations that I think you could have, maybe not in all these circles, but at least in six of them. I think you would be able to dive in quicker there than most other consulting firms could, to be honest, because of your background as Navigators. These on the outer circle, set direction. This is all about basic setting goals, you know, ensuring that the organization has clarity around purpose, values, that everybody in the organization learns. There's a difference between a leader that has vision versus a leader is able to share vision, you know, across an organization. So this skill set is all about that. Thinking strategically, this is the one that, you know, some of you might be able to do this and some of you can't. But this is all about creating the mindset and the DNA within a leader, within an organization, and this goes back to the conference board research, that leaders have got to learn how to think strategically. And so for most organizations, especially if you're dealing with privately held or entrepreneurial or smaller businesses, they haven't had any formal thinking or training around that. So we believe this is an important piece, a component for leaders. If they're going to be building an enduring organization, they've got to be skilled and create a DNA within the organization that thinks strategically. It's different from strategic planning. Aligning resources has everything to do with ensuring that your strategies, your people, your culture, your systems are all aligned around what it is that you're trying to achieve. Motivating, inspiring. I think that's self-explanatory, but high-performing organizations and high-performing leaders, high-performing organizations, are very motivated and inspired around what they do, and there's a whole set of skills there in terms of what leaders do. A lot of that, I feel you guys have the skill set. And now the ones that I find are interesting, now I want you to remember, this comes from our youth, are these over here, focusing on others. We're going to talk about that one. I'm going to go deep on that one a little bit. Execute and follow through. This is the fundamentals of management, business management. You know, you have to be able to execute and follow through on everything. Up here, you've got lead within. Anybody want to take a guess on what lead within means?
Even though it may not be a particular position in the Corinthians. So if there's a rumor or negative activity, we'll be sort of inspired in the right direction.
Okay.
Perhaps take some initiative.
That's a great shot at it. That's a great shot at it. What we mean by lead within is effective leaders are very focused around their personal mission and the organization's mission, and they've evaluated how those overlap. So personal mission. They're also very effective and very focused around character and the character development of their organization. Now, I want you to think about this, because we've been creating these 2 and 3 day workshops now. And again, our business is from the state of Georgia to Zurich, you know, insurance. They provide a lot of insurance and funding and surety to the construction industry. But you should imagine or envision what it's like for us to be having these conversations inside of Zurich, because the question I'll ask those guys, I'll say, do you believe that as a senior leadership team that you can impact the character development of young people coming into your organization? And what do you think the answer invariably is?
No.
It's yes, they can. They can. And I'll say, okay, I tend to agree with them. But and if you continue to create these kind of conversations, you can imagine how deep it gets. Because you cannot not talk about spiritual things at some point if you keep pushing on that. And again, the intention here is, how do we create framework for conversations inside of organizations that all leaders are having all the time? Because if we really believe, and I got to tell you, this is a huge issue for business across the world, if we really believe that ethics is either going to make or break most organizations today, then the question becomes, what becomes the corporate responsibility of leaders to be developing the character of those that they lead? It's huge. And so the question that I have for you, and the question we have for ourselves, is how do we become more effective at creating conversations inside of businesses that get them focused on understanding character development? So this morning we talked about this environment of grace that Eddie was talking about, but components that we talk about are integrity, humility, dignity. You know, dignity I thought was a great word this morning, this morning's study that Eddie brought to the table. We talk about dignity when it comes to management succession. And if you're really thinking about the character of your people and the development of your people, part of dignity is being accurate in your assessment around what people's capabilities are. Because to promote somebody above their ability doesn't do them any good. And you haven't served, and you're not creating a culture, you know, that's really focused on them. And so this component of learning how to lead within is huge, because it not only talks about character, but it talks about trust. And it talks about personal disciplines. When we talk about learning to lead within as a leader, we talk about personal disciplines. That one of the things that we see across the board, across America today, is that if a young person in their 30s really doesn't create for themselves real strong personal disciplines around knowing how to handle multiple demands, pace of life, schedule, all of those kind of personal disciplines, chances are they never will. They'll spit out. And Stanley was the one that kind of put this in my mind years ago when he and Bobby Clinton wrote that book on mentoring. And they've got that timeline, the life stages of a leader. If you haven't read that book, it's very insightful. But all of that would validate that thinking, that when you think about personal disciplines, you need to be having conversations inside your organization with your people around their personal disciplines. And this affects spiritual, emotional, thinking. It's their physical. It's the way they handle their family, finances. It's all of that. Yeah, Jim?
Do they understand, those leaders, that they've got to have that character before they can build? How do you handle that? It's got to start with you.
Yeah. Well, the beauty is, all we're doing is asking the questions. Because remember, we're a secular business. And so in the context of asking those questions, invariably what comes up is this question about, now wait a second. I know I'm supposed to do this, but I really struggle with this, and I haven't figured out yet how to do that. Ron, what do you know about how people make these kinds of changes and shifts? It's wide open. It's wide open. And I got to tell you, it's so encouraging. I know Harv's been on the periphery of our business, but it's so encouraging because I can tell you that on a weekly basis, we get emails from people who are asking these hard questions. And for those that are believers, because we're dealing with so many, you know, thousands of people, that those are the believers are coming out of the woodwork and they're just jumping all over this because they've always wondered what are the kinds of questions we can ask and how does this apply to our business as a business model? Because again, the research will validate that high performing organizations and great leaders are having these kind of conversations inside their organization. And so if we can be engaged as believers in coaching those that we're with to be seeing the framework of their leadership responsibilities different, I think that you will all enjoy just the opportunity to watch those that we're influencing to have much more penetrating and fruitful conversations in the context of their workplace. Because most leaders don't know how to have those conversations at work. They just wait for that occasional once in a, you know, 2 month opportunity where somebody just kind of opens up at the lunchroom to have this conversation. And what we're saying is I think we can be much more purposeful about these conversations if we understand organizational design and if we really understand leadership and leadership coaching for those executives that you're working with. Develop talents at top. And again, I don't have time to get into this, but we have got some phenomenal stuff around developing talent. And I've thought about this for the navigators. I don't know how good we are at it. Because the more I've looked at our content, the more I've realized, I don't know how good we are. We might be very good. You know, and I haven't been as integrally involved as I had been in the past with the organization, but I've questioned that. Because in my past, I would have to say I probably wasn't very good at it. I was an intuitive leader. I was an inspirational leader. I could encourage people. But I didn't have any idea about any kind of process for development of talent. And so I would encourage you to think about that because I do believe that that would be very easy for all of you to learn. And if you really understood development of talent and you could begin to have these conversations in a coaching relationship with your businessman that you're working with, the impact can be very dramatic because when you get to those conversations around development of talent, you are now hitting the center of the bullseye again in terms of where every individual leader resides. They're always wondering about, where am I going with my life and what am I trying to become and what do I develop? And if you, as a leader, a business leader, can learn how to have these conversations, you will be amazed at where these conversations take you in terms of spiritual ministry and opportunity.
Tony? Just a quick point. I don't know if you've read that book by Lee Ellis called Leading Talents, Leading Teams. Mm-mm. And The Right Path Profile. I think it comes out somewhere east. And a very good book helping to, first of all, discern behavior of where people are. And then
yeah. Leading Talent, Leading Teams, by who?
By Lee Ellis.
Lee Ellis, okay. Good. And I can send you all kinds of other resources too if you're looking for resources to read or how to get in, you know, how to learn more about these skills as leaders or as coaches in your case. I want to focus on others just because I thought this was the most interesting for me. Again, realize, I want you to remember that the majority of the people putting together this particular module are secular. Non-believers. I mean, they're off the charts. They're all, you know, they're 25-year-olds doing lots of research, doing a lot of thinking. So you can get your own imagination going. When they came up with, for FMI, what do we mean by focusing on others? Now, we have 2 days and 4 days of content and development and coaching that goes behind each one of these topics. So this is a flyby. They said, we think that focusing on others is equal to emotional quotient, and I'll define that here in a minute for you, plus humility to the power of agapeo. To the power of agapeo.
These are secular
people. And again, if you look at research, if you're aware of what's going on in the workplace, it's a pretty phenomenal thing. But there's a VP of Yahoo that's written this book called The Killer App. You guys know what a killer app is in general? You know, it's that computer software application that just kind of takes everything out because it's the next level of efficiency and effectiveness. Well, the title of his book was Love is the Killer App. And there are lots of books coming out right now and thinking around what is the role of community in a high-performing workplace? Because we talk about people burning out and being on the outer edge of stress and all that goes with that. And what people are beginning to realize is, you know what? We're not getting where we want to go, and it's not very sustainable at the pace we're running. So what are the missing quotients that take us to the next level of performance? This team came up with focus on others equals emotional quotient plus humility taken to the power of agape. Now, focusing on others intuitively, I haven't talked on that, but intuitively most of you would know that great leaders have got to be able to focus on other people. Now, again, if you're coaching and if you're having hard conversations with these executive leaders, this is a very personal issue. And when you continue to push and you continue to have these conversations, and we have them all the time. On this humility issue, I was with a firm just 3 weeks ago in California. It's a big, big firm, and his particular region is a $600 million piece of the business. And he got all kinds of feedback on his 360s around not being a humble person. Well, I gave him his 360. And I said, Eric, you've got to pay attention to this. I said, this humility thing will take you out. And it's the reason why you personally feel unfulfilled. Here's a guy that's a multi-gazillionaire, has built a great business. He was in the start. It's only an 11-year-old business, 12-year-old business. But he feels totally unfulfilled because he knows he's not connecting with anybody. He's a lonely person. Got more money than he knows what to do with, high-performing organization. And he got this feedback around humility and ego. And he just wanted to, he was a typical executive. It was a little bit of Teflon action going on. Yeah, I understand. I said, Eric, that's not going to cut it. I said, you have to understand what these people, this is the only time probably, unless you don't take this message seriously, this is a gift to you that people are trying to tell you. You know, your ego's out of control here. We need to talk about this. And so I gave him some coaching. He went back that night, and he was pretty blown away, needless to say. But I challenged him the next morning when I got together. I said, now, Eric, I know we haven't had a transformation of heart here, but hopefully you got the message. He says, Ron, I got the message. He says, I've got to work on this. I'm going to commit to some personal coaching with you guys. So I said, okay, I want you to think about how you're going to present this to your team at the end of the day. Well, he gets up there and just does a wonderful job just talking about what he learned in his feedback about himself in this area of humility. Well, we gave him the book. I don't know how many of you read this book. It's called The Servant. Has anybody read that book? It's written by a business guy. Lots of biblical practice in there, though, right?
He spends his however long with monk.
Yep, he's at a monastery. He emails me back. This was 2 weeks ago. He says, Ron, that book was unbelievable. Now Eric, Stanford, you know, kind of guy who got his master's degree at Stanford. He's kind of a new agey type person. He says, that was phenomenal. He says, an easy read, simple context, but the impact on my thinking has been phenomenal. Because they end up in that book talking about love. And that at the core is really seeing love as a verb. And we're going to talk about this here in a minute. But I share these stories because the only way I would have had this conversation with them is because our kids put together this formula that created the opportunity for me to have conversations with a significant leader about a significant part of his life. And we see this every single day with every single interaction we have. Because this is truth that's speaking into their heart. Now, let me just dive into this. Are there some questions?
I have one.
Yeah, go ahead.
You. Let's come back.
Okay. All right. Anybody else before? Emotional quotient. Emotional quotient. It's right here. Emotional quotient is recognizing and harnessing the power of his or her other's emotions as a source of information, connection, energy, and influence. I'm not going to give a seminar. Most of you have heard the term, I would hope, or emotional intelligence. But what we do is we go through every word with the people. And we talk about, well, what does it mean to recognize your emotions? And what does it mean to harness now the power of that emotion? Because what we find, again, in these conversations, and I know you will find it if you ask the right questions, and if you're pursuing the right kind of thinking with those that you're coaching, that their emotional intelligence is zippo. You know, that's why most leaders don't get anywhere. Is because they're not aware of how other people are feeling or how the team is responding to their leadership or what's going on with this pressure cooker environment. So we talk to them about this and we define, you know, what's going on, what does this mean, you know, how does this impact you? Then we say, you have a choice to make. You can be in a real bad situation, whatever that stimulus is, and you will have an initial internal response. You've been screwed at work, somebody's yelling at you on the phone. Somebody made just an unbelievably stupid mistake. I just went through one of these this week. Really, really stupid. Huge implications. But you'll have this response. But the key is that you get to make a choice with your response. And so If you can play this out and you're having these conversations with your leaders and they're beginning to have it inside their organization as they think about developing other leaders, these create interesting conversations because the questions that you'll get back is, well, how do you control it? You know, I mean, I really am pissed. You know, and I really want to reach out and choke that guy, or I really don't care about that person. We have a lot of those, by the way. That's another interesting one that comes out. If you can learn to have these kind of conversations with leaders, one of the things that you'll find are that those that are in your ministry will discover, if they become savvy at asking these kinds of questions and having these kind of conversations, is you'll be surprised how many people do not like people. Period. And as you dig into it, they get honest with it. And they realize that has severe implications on their trajectory with their career, with their leadership, with dreams that they may have had. And you get close to the heart of the matter again, because they will ask you, what's wrong with me? Why am I like this? What do I need to do different? Here's a question that we asked. I just asked this question in Costa Rica, and we had a whole room of CEOs. We had about 30 of them. And it was amazing because a couple of them actually teared up as they thought about this question. If I took full responsibility for every response I make and for the impact my responses have on others, I would do what? And I tell you what, you know, the impact of this question, and they were just thinking, wow, you know, I'm supposed to. And if I'm really going to be a leader that's focused on other people rather than myself, I've got to figure out, what would I do differently if I took responsibility for every response I make and for the impact that had? Lots of deep conversation. Then we get into humility. That's the second part of that equation, right? And our definition of humility, just to keep it simple, is over the first one. It's not thinking less of yourself, because that's what most people jump to. It's degrading themselves. Okay, I'm not very good at stuff. But it's really thinking of yourself less. So if you can do that, then by implication, you're going to be focusing on other people more. We can go into humility, but that's enough. But you can get this, again, if you have this framework, that you can begin to have questions and interact and have your people having these kind of conversations inside the organization, you can begin to imagine the dramatic impact that it has in giving you opportunity for influence. This comes out of Jim Collins' last book, Good to Great. I think most of you said you read it, so I'm not going to belabor the point. But, you know, there's huge amounts of research. Go back.
Thank you.
Sure. But that level 5 leadership stuff is all research-based. And we know Jim real well, and he would tell us. He says, man, if you guys can ask the question, how do you create humility in a leader, you can make a lot of money in this world. Because there's a lot of people who are influenced by this thinking, and they go, okay, that was nice to read, but how do you do it? There's a number of components to that, but absolutely. Absolutely. That's exactly right. Right. And if he sees the world as zero sum, then he's got other problems. You know, I mean, that just creates all kinds of conundrums philosophically for a leader. And all of you guys know how to deal. You know how to monkey with a person's mind when you get there. You know, so you're in your sweet spot now when you're talking to a leader who's asking those kinds of questions. And that's our intent, you know, at least from a biblical perspective as a leader of a firm, is how do we create questions that every leader in an organization needs to be wrestling with to drive the performance of the organization where they want it to go. So it's been a lot of fun. Level 5 leadership. Okay, here's some questions that we've asked. And again, when you think the responses that we get when we get people to this point in the conversations are unbelievably open. Because nobody's ever had this conversation with them, unless they went to church or was around some organized religion. But for those that have never been exposed to this, this is like all brand new stuff. But their intuition is going, truth, truth, truth. You know, this is right. No wonder I haven't been happy here. No wonder I didn't like what was going on over here. And they're leaning forward, you know, because they're wanting to learn more and understand more about things that they've never been exposed to before. Agapeo. Here's the definition that, and I have anything to do with this. Doing what is in the best interest of others, with or without their knowledge, unconditionally over time. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
And when these researchers put this together, they said the key is not only the ability to recognize emotional indicators out there, what's going on with those that you work with, as well as what's going on internally to you. It's not only to act with humility and to think of yourself less, but it's really to take all of that to another power of agapeo, which means that I'm thinking about the best interests of others with or without their knowledge. I don't need the credit for it, and I'm doing it unconditionally over time. Well, you should hear the conversations in the room. And these CEOs, you know, in Costa Rica are going, holy cow, you know, where'd that come from? But they're all going, that makes a lot of sense. And some of them actually in that room had already experienced the family health. One of them was a family health business about I don't know what their size was. Let's see, they had 300 people. So it must have been about a $40 million business. And he said that he had to fire his son this year. And that was the hardest thing he'd ever done in his life. But as he reflected, you know, he said, this is the key. He says, you know, I was such a controller. And I wanted my son to do certain things. And he said, I never heard of this before. I never thought of this before. But he says, this is really the key to really growing talent, growing people, and growing an environment where people can thrive. I could go on and on with stories. Oh, you can tell these are the kids putting this together. But one of the things that they do with these pictures, and the theme of this picture is to say, agapeo is a verb. It's not a noun, it's a verb, which means that it's a behavior, it's an activity. So it's not something that you feel, it's something that you do. So in the context of this one sliver, when we're talking about focusing on others, the emphasis is on really helping people understand that agapeo is a verb. It's moving in action. Of course, then we ask these kind of questions. Which aspect of agapeo is hardest for you? Can you imagine? And can you imagine having these leaders going back and asking these same questions inside their organization? Most of the time they don't. Most of the time they hire us to come back in and do it. But they participate. It's safe, but they don't know. This is the first time they've been exposed to it too, and they're going, wow. I'm not even really sure how I'd respond to some of the responses I would get. You know, so I need somebody in here who will help us really think the implications of this out. You know, what does this mean when we think about the best interests of others with or without their knowledge, you know, unconditionally? You know, what does that mean? You know, and so there's just lots of organizational implications for that.
Are these questions your questions or what the kids came up with?
Yeah, what the kids came up with.
Are you seeing what I'm seeing in these questions regarding followers, agape? I mean, this is...
You know what's cool is that we know that every one of these kids are moving towards the kingdom. I came back and one of them was in the room. She wanted to debrief, Joyelle, and I said, Joyelle, I said, I just got to tell you something. I said, it's amazing what happens when you come and you speak truth. And she knows where I'm coming from. So I said, you know, the scriptures are so full of truth. And what you have captured here is biblical truth. And when you speak truth, it just stands on its own 2 feet. And so I just said, I just want to thank you for all the work that you guys have put into this. Because the impact on these leaders was absolutely phenomenal. But these kids are moving towards the kingdom. Yeah, it's very clear. Their conversations are changing. You know, they're not nearly as nervous about talking about the Bible. As a matter of fact, I was in one of their product development meetings, and Jake is a young kid. He's 24. He read from 1 Corinthians 13. He says, now let's talk. He says, this is what I was just reading. He says, you know, tracking down the agapeo verbiage and, you know, all the history. And he says, I landed on this reading from 1 Corinthians 13. So he had a Bible there. And he read from 1 Corinthians. It's probably the first time he's ever read the Bible, you know. But it's incredible to see, you know, how truth in the business context can stand on its own 2 feet and create conversations that are very reproducible. It's not hard to do.
Over here, Jim.
Who pointed toward the Bible? How did these non-Christians think about going and finding about
agapeo? You know, all you have to do is go to the dictionary. And if you just do some basic word study and word search for love, because they were looking for love. As a matter of fact, in my facilitating notes over there, I've got a whole page. Because at first they were looking at it from a noun, and there's like 20 different definitions of love, from making love, you know, the physical act of love, to, you know, coveting food. I mean, it was very interesting. And they said, that can't be it. And they kept pursuing. And the Greek, you know how it is, and it says Greek and Latin extensions, and they just tracked it down.
Did they come up with anything on Leo Viscardi's work?
On what?
Leo Viscardi's work. He wrote a whole lot on
that. I don't know.
About a decade ago.
I don't know. They do a lot of reading. I mean, I got a stack of, you know, and I.
He's not a Christian, but he can't.
Right.
You know, all the behaviors.
Right. I don't know.
Just what we need is this cross and doing it.
Yeah.
Well, could you just back away for a minute and just from 9/11 to the present, the Enron, Devoe, Martin, Martha Stewart, all, you're talking about change being probably the only constant. What has happened from your perspective in the marketplace that is relevant to our mission? What is the change in the DNA, the values, the uncertainty that's created, the new influx of spirituality? Can you summarize from your perspective what you think is happening, at least in America, and why is it important?
I don't know if I can really do that eloquently. We've alluded to it a few times today. I think that there are always generational events that mark every generation. You know, so with the seniors that are in this room, it might have been the Great Depression or World War II. For the boomers, it could have been Nixon, you know, the growing cynicism at authoritarian levels. For the Xers, there's all kinds of significant events for them. And then when you think about this generation, the thing that this generation has seen has been hugely radical events, you know, that touch the emotion of people at a very deep level. So to watch an Enron that was fast on the track to being the number largest organization in the world go away in a very short period of time, and that affected hundreds of thousands of people in their retirement, everything that they knew. You look at the tragedies with the tsunami. Across the board, I think that what's happening is that there's just an unbelievable recognition that the pace of life that we run at isn't getting us anywhere. And it's not valuable in terms of a pursuit. The young kids today, you know, if you're, again, this is a whole different direction, but if you're recruiting people into an organization today, they don't care about stock ownership in a company. I mean, that's the last thing to think about, because they're not even thinking they're going to be there for 2 or 3 years. You know, the sets of questions that young people are asking about today are more focused around themselves. What am I going to learn? You know, how is this going to develop me in my own personal career? What skills will be transferable, you know, in my time with you, so I can continue to move in my own personal pathway? But I think when they look around the horizon, they go, I don't see anything attractive out there. You know, so they look at the boomers, and they go, the boomers, you know, in the mid-'80s, corporate America kicked out all the pensions. Then it was us-ins that had 60% divorce rate. So, you know, the Xers are the ones going, not a whole lot pretty about this group. You know, both mom and dads worked, so they gave their lives to work. They ended up getting divorced. They got a lot of money. They got nice toys, but they don't have a life. You know, they don't have a life. And they're thinking, okay, I want all the toys, but I don't want to do it the way you guys did it. But they're trying to figure out, well, what does that mean? You know, how do I get from where I am to where I need to go? So there are a lot of deep social questions like that that I think young people and the workplace are there's just a lot of conversations that are going on, which I think, I said the word earlier, so I'm kind of rambling here, but I do think that there's a sense of this need for community. And people are trying to discover community. You know, what does it mean to live in community with people at work, you know, in my local neighborhood or whatever group you happen to be hanging around with? But what's the essence of community? Yes, Steve.
To Dwight's question, I think that business in general had no rules. It was whatever it was. And they had no template of goodness. It was what either the corporate culture had been created as, what the mentor before them in the business cycle was, and if they cheated at the end of the month, then that was their business philosophy. If they lied to shareholders, that was the way the next guy stepped in. It became almost anything went. And I think each corporation almost had its own set of guidelines. No absolutes. Now they get caught, and somebody says, Sarbanes-Oxley, this lying stuff doesn't work anymore. They don't know how to do it. They do not know. They have no template, no matrix, no value system for these people who have grown up through the corporations. They have no basic guideline. We do. No worldview, no central focus, no value system that doesn't change. You know, you look at that networking book, the book, the connecting book that you talked about, Stanford Together. One of his little games he plays that I took people to put jigsaw puzzles, and I let them look at the jigsaw puzzle like we all do in the picture, and look at split and put it together. Red's over here, green's over here. Try to pull them together without the picture and see how long it takes you. And that's what business in the U.S. has been asked to do. I want you to operate a business, and you don't have a picture anymore. You figure out how you do it. Don't lie to a shareholder. Don't make the wrong decisions. Don't lose your employees. You know, and I think they're really struggling with what is that framework that I can put together. I think that's why they're so hungry for, can you give me a framework to operate in that will allow me to be successful, that I can meet these compliance things? And they don't happen to know what our framework is necessarily, but I think they're so hungry for some framework that allows them to be truthful and honest and genuine and sincere. And instead of talking about employees as assets, that's one of the things I said to Bob, and the followers I put there. You never stand by the followers up there. It's employees. These are my assets. These are my resources. What about the people who are following your lead? People that you're modeling for. You know? So I think that's a big change. And they're being forced to be compliant, but they don't have the tools. So I think that's how it fits with what we do. I think we have the tools today to allow them in an absolute sense to put together the model that works for the business.
Well, that is very well said. I mean, you know, I commend you on that, because we even asked Enron, and they sent us a 32-page paper that they had just finished writing on their values. And Enron. And the impact that must have had, if you were a part of that culture, to have to go through whatever training they were going through around their values, and then to watch the implosion of their organization in just a blink of an eye, must have sent just an incredible message to, you know, a couple hundred thousand people. And you take that to the way you were describing, you know, there's just a huge hunger out there. That's why I want to challenge you. I want to challenge us to think differently about our ministry, because I do believe at my core, because I'm seeing it, I see it every day, that the things I'm talking about, any one of you could talk about if you thought differently about the kinds of questions and the way you were trying to develop those that you're coaching to be effective in the workplace. That you could have a direct impact on the bottom line as well as the organizational design of businesses if you saw your opportunity for influence perhaps a little bit differently than you currently do at an organizational level, not just individual.
Let me toss in just a real small point. Yeah. But I thought it was significant when you use followers instead of employees as a, it made me think of the power of words, the choice of words that are used, and how that creates culture. Yeah. And I hadn't connected that as I was scrabbling notes down here. But when you said that, I thought that's probably part of this whole worldview culture thing that is significant, maybe more than we know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've gone over time. I'll see you at dinner. Thank you, guys.